Welcome to episode 7 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith, and in this episode, we're talking about cults. Oh boy, I'm getting the heebie-jeebies already. Half of you just turned the episode off. Cults are not popular to talk about for obvious reasons, but I've chosen to cover this topic because I believe it to be a huge problem that has very little awareness and support for it. And I've known many people who have found themselves in cults and have not known what to do. And the reality is these people feel trapped. They are. I mean, psychologically, they are not their own person. Many people think that cults are not around anymore, but this is not the case, and in fact, there are more types and shapes and sizes of cults than ever. The conversation you're about to hear is with cult expert Janja Lalić, a woman whose name is as beautiful as her story. Janja realized she was in a cult after years and years of participation and managed to not only get out, but started a new life and became one of the world's leading experts on cults, and now spends all of her time helping the victims of cults rebuild their lives. It's an awesome thing that she's doing. Janja and I could not get it together in person, so this was done over Skype, and the audio on Janja's end is not ideal at certain points, but I'm releasing it as is because I think the content of her message is so important, and I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of it. And so without further ado, here is my conversation about cults with Dr. Janja Lalić. I'm joined today by world-renowned expert in cultic studies, Janja Lalić, author of Bounded Choice, True Believers and Charismatic Cults. Janja, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A little background on you. You have a PhD in human and organizational systems from Fielding Graduate University in Santa Barbara, California, and you are a professor in the sociology department of California State University, Chico.
That's right.
So I guess the first question I have for you, Janja, is what kind of a person studies cults for a living?
Well, in my case, it's because I was in a cult myself in the 70s and 80s. And after I sort of recovered from that experience and got my life back together, I decided, well, I was doing a lot of studying on my own. And so then I decided I wanted to go on to graduate school. I had already had my undergraduate degree when I joined the cult. So I, I just wanted to deepen my knowledge and have a better understanding of these experiences. And so that's how I ended up studying cults.
How long were you involved with that cult you were in?
About 10 and a half years.
Long time.
Yeah.
How did you get out? Was there somebody that helped you, or was it just personal growth?
Well, actually, I'd been unhappy for a number of years, and I couldn't figure out how to get out. I was sort of psychologically frozen. And in the end, we all got out because the cult sort of imploded, and we expelled our leader, and everybody was free. And it's a very unusual ending for a cult. I can only think of one other that ended in a similar way. And so then, we were all out. There were about 120 of us at that point, and we all helped each other get jobs and buy clothes and for interviews and supported each other in that way. And so that's how it happened.
Sounds like it didn't take much for that cult to fall apart.
Well, everybody was pretty burned out at that point. You know, we'd been working 20-hour days, 7 days a week for years and years and years. And the leader got more and more erratic and more drunk. She was a severe alcoholic, and those of us in the inner circle kind of kept the other members sheltered from her. But then, we were a political organization, and our purported goal was to bring about social change in America, fight racism and sexism and things like that. And more the things that we were doing, things that she wanted to do, had really nothing to do with our original goal. And so people were getting pretty disgruntled on top of being absolutely exhausted, and none of it made any sense anymore. And so it sort of clicked with everybody at the same time.
So they were actually making you guys work 20 hours a week.
Absolutely. 20 hours a day.
20 hours a day?
Yeah, 20 hours a day.
Just doing whatever they want?
Yeah, I mean, we were supposed to be a political cult, so we were doing a lot of organizing in workplaces, you know, calling demonstrations, leading study groups, organizing front groups for recruitment, producing a lot of documents. We had a print shop where people worked pretty much around the clock.
Wow.
Printing our documents and also printing for outside sources. So that was one of the ways we earned money. And if you had a job outside of the cult, then you worked your day job or whatever it was, and then you immediately reported to one of our facilities and just kept working.
Quite the operation they had going.
Yes, it was.
How many people today are unknowingly trapped in what would be defined as a cult?
There are probably thousands of groups, certainly thousands of groups around the world, and probably a good couple thousand in America. And, you know, I'd say most people probably have some doubts that they kind of put in the back of their head, but having that sort of personal awakening where you realize you're in, you might not think of it as a cult immediately, but that you're in some kind of abusive or harmful group, you know, it takes time for someone to get to that point.
What characteristics are associated with cults?
Well, for me, the major sort of criteria are, first of all, that there's a charismatic leader who offers some kind of promise of whatever someone might be looking for. I mean, it's going to depend on the kind of cult. But the charismatic leader claims to have the answer and have the path to whether it's salvation or riches or weight loss or just self-improvement, in our case, political revolution, whatever that might be. So first, there's that charismatic leader. Second, what I look for is a transcendent belief system, and that's a belief system that offers you the answers to everything, the past, the present, and the future. And along with that comes what I call the recipe for change, that you're required to go through a personal transformation, and the instructions or the way in which you have to carry out that transformation is dictated by the cult. And so it's not like an ordinary religion or group that you might join that has high ideals. And, you know, for example, your local church might say, be nice to your neighbor, but nobody's coming and checking up on you to see if you're being nice to your neighbor. So in the cult, there's an absolute way that you have to change and carry out that change. And then finally comes what I call the systems of influence and control. And those are the obvious rules and regulations and ways to behave, and then the more subtle sort of peer influences and pressures like guilt and shame and fear that keep you in line and keep you going along with the program.
So you've got somebody at the top who's got some agenda, and that agenda is communicated to the people in, by way of a message that resonates with them, and then they use guilt and shame to keep people running in circles.
Essentially, yes. I mean, more than guilt and shame, but yes, there's all kinds of influences and all kinds of controls.
What do you think makes people join cults?
Well, I think, ultimately we're social beings, and people want to belong to something. People want to find a framework for understanding the world or their life, especially today when things are so complex and complicated. And people want to have purpose in their life. So if I find any common denominator among the people who are members of cults, it's idealism. You know, some way that people want to change the world or change themselves or change their families. And they'll, you know, get invited to something or see an ad for something or see something on the internet and it looks interesting, and so they'll take that first step.
So you said that there's usually a charismatic leader and that this leader has some kind of ideology or worldview that they're trying to promote. What do all these leaders have in common? What's the underlying motive that you see?
I think the underlying motives are generally money, sex, or power, or some combination of those three. Most cult leaders are are narcissistic individuals. It's all about them. And so they want to, they will create some kind of worldview that gives them whatever satisfaction they're looking for. Very few cult leaders, in my opinion, start out as, you know, genuine human beings with a message. There might be a few like that who perhaps have some kind of psychotic incident where they think God talks to them and they go from there. But in my opinion, most of them are just straight out charlatans.
So there's something off of them from the get-go.
Yes. And depending on the way in which they're so-called off, depending on their proclivities, that will, in a sense, dominate the type of cult it's going to be. So if it's someone who is very violent and into guns and things like that, then it might be a group that's armed and engages in harmful activities, both on the inside and outside the group. If it's someone who's obsessed with sex, there will be a lot of sex abuse within the cult. So it's the various proclivities of the cult leader that kind of determine the nature of the organization and the inner workings of the organization. And then as a charismatic leader is allowed to go on without any kinds of checks and balances, they tend to get worse and worse in a sense, because nobody's calling them on their crap, if I may be so blunt.
Right, yeah.
As long as they keep getting away with stuff, they'll get more and more extreme.
Yeah, it sounds like this type of person would have to get really good and really comfortable lying to people and putting on a fake image in order to get people to continue helping them.
Yes.
Highly manipulative.
Right. And what's most important is that they set up that inner circle around them, or a team of lieutenants, or whatever term you want to use, the people who will go out and continue recruiting and carrying out the orders of the leader. And the leader, once they have a following, even a small following, they don't have to really do so much anymore, because these lieutenants will go out and carry out spreading the beliefs, recruiting and acting. We call it charisma by proxy. So it could be that people never even meet the cult leader. All they do is hear about him, or them, him or her. They may read the writings, or they may listen to audio tapes or things like that. And the charismatic leader can, in a sense, almost take a back seat, because everyone else is doing the work, the layers of members.
Right. They've got a squad of flying monkeys doing all their dirty work.
Exactly.
And what happens with these flying monkeys when the system begins to deteriorate, like the cult you were in did? I imagine there'd be a lot of disillusionment, turnover in attendance, rumors about people, things like that.
Yes, in the case of our group, there were, very well known, in a sense, very popular leaders, middle level leaders, and even high leaders who were either kicked out. And then stories were made up about them, about how horrible they were, or people left, they snuck out in the night and somehow got away. And so things were getting very uneven. And there was a lot of internal questioning among the members. And so coupling that with the fact that the leader was less and less around and more removed from the group and talking about things that and wanting to do things that distance us from our original goals, I think that's what started really shaking people up. So often in a group, there might be internal dissension. Sometimes there are scandals. There are lawsuits that generally the cult will try to keep hidden from the rest of the members. But in some cases, these lawsuits are found out about it, and that may cause a stream of people to leave. So it's important, as much as someone can, to measure the stability, the internal stability. And of course, if a cult leader dies, that's another time when
people may leave because there may be a power struggle for who's going to take over. And then maybe someone who's not well-liked or people feel doesn't deserve to be that top leader, you know, that may cause people to break away.
Is it possible that there are any good cults?
In my opinion, no. I believe that cults exist on a continuum of more extreme to more benign. But what cults do is they strive for conformity, right? All the members have to conform and in a sense give up their autonomy and their critical thinking. So even a benign cult is going to be doing at least that much, right? Getting you to conform, taking over parts of your life. So in my opinion, that's never good.
They're going to try to get you to suspend your disbelief.
Right. And especially for children who don't choose to be in these groups, that's harmful, in my opinion, because their development is going to be restricted and stultified by the norms of the cult.
What would you say to someone who thinks they may be in a cult?
Oh, that's a tough one. It really depends on the person. It depends on their age, their experience in the group, what level they're at. Certainly, you can't go to someone and say, hey, did you know you're in a cult? Because that's not going to work. That's just going to make them defensive. So I think the important thing is to try to sort of spark their critical thinking again. And that may be by just reminding them of things in the past, reminding them of things they've given up, very, very slowly and tactfully, you know, questioning maybe some of the beliefs that might be more, you know, completely out of the ordinary. That's a tough one because everyone's so different. And the way in which someone's going to respond to someone from the outside sort of challenging them is different.
Well, let me rephrase it then. What about if someone thinks they may be in a cult, what steps should they take?
Well, if someone thinks they may be in a cult, I would say the first thing to do is get online and start searching and search for ex-members of your group. Many groups have set up websites now. The ex-members have set up websites where there's a lot of information. If you know people who've left the group and you're able to get in touch with them, try to do that and speak with them and find out why they left the group. Try to find go to family members who may not have been in the group and who can shelter you. And I always say to families or friends, you know, always leave that door open. Always let the person believe there's a safe haven they can go to, because leaving a cult is one of the most difficult things. You're basically giving up your entire worldview and you've got to start all over again. And so it's a very scary proposition. So if you're in a cult and you're having doubts, probably you don't want to share them with someone in the cult because they'll probably turn you in. So the best thing is to try to find ways that you can contact people who will help you and have some conversations with you and help you get out.
What, in your mind, would be the healthiest picture of organized religion, and how would that differ from a cult?
Well, first of all, not all cults are religious, so I just want to make sure people understand that. But in a healthy religion, you should be praying to or believing in or honoring a higher power of some sort, whether that's God or Allah or a tree, whatever it might be. But you're not praying to and being led by this human being right in front of you. That's where religions can go wrong. When the pastor believes he's the spokesperson for God, and the pastor believes that he can tell you whatever to do and starts controlling your life. Also, typically, a healthy religion will belong to a larger denomination where there's accountability and people can be held accountable for their behaviors. Now, obviously, the Catholic Church is a good example of how that didn't work. And it took years and years and years for, say, the sexual abuse crimes to come out. But in a healthy religion, if you think the pastor's doing something wrong, you should be able to go to the next level above and report him, and there'll be an investigation. This is the problem today with so many of these non-denominational churches, these kind of storefront churches or churches run out of somebody's home. Because they're non-denominational, they don't belong to any larger body, so there's no system of accountability. And that's where, even if someone starts out as a, you know, genuine believer thinking he's just going to have his little church in his house, well, once he starts being worshipped, as we know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And most people can't handle that kind of, you know, adulation and power. And then things start to get corrupt.
You're saying that accountability is important to keep people responsible for their actions, and a denomination will help enforce this. Do you think that even with a denomination or some kind of chain of command in place, corruption is still possible?
Yes. I mean, obviously, any kind of leadership can get corrupt. I mean, in the business world, in any context. And that's why I think, if we're talking about religion, parishioners have to keep on their toes, and they need to use their critical thinking. And if something doesn't seem right, if there's some, you know, if their gut's telling them, I don't know, this pastor or this priest is getting a little, you know, high on the hog, and it seems like he's, you know, demanding too much or whatever it might be. Yes, that can happen. But I do know of cases where in, you know, various mainstream churches, that kind of corruption or abuse has happened. And, you know, people have been removed because others did take action and report that person. So, you know, in a sense, even in church or going to church, people need to be good consumers and, you know, be sure they're getting what they paid for.
Yeah, well, maybe most people don't think of the religious and political organizations they associate themselves with as a service that they're paying for. And so this is why they start feeling guilty and afraid when they start asking questions.
Right. Well, it's guilt, and it's also, you know, people feel, there's several things. People feel committed and generally have made a commitment, often an oral commitment, to be part of it or to do certain things. And most people are, you know, decent, genuine, honest people. And so when you make a commitment, you usually want to abide by that. You want to carry through. You don't want to seem like you're, you know, some kind of slug and you're walking away from your promises. So most people will carry out their commitments. So there's that. And there's also the fact that, you know, people make an investment, and it's often difficult to admit to yourself that you invested in the wrong thing. So there's a number of factors that are going to weigh on somebody before they're going to really take a stand.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, any kind of reinvention of yourself on that level is going to be intimidating, and it's going to always be easier to just stay where you are and not ask questions, especially when the people who are leading you are encouraging you not to ask questions, the very thing that humans do best.
Exactly. It's important to remember, you know, a charismatic relationship is, from the get-go, it's based on an imbalance of power. The person who you consider to be charismatic has that power over you. And so right from the start, you're in an inferior position. And we're all raised, of course, to respect authority and to listen to authority and not talk back. So all these things kind of gel together to make it a perfect match.
Just from talking to you over the last week, it seems like you attend quite a few funerals. Do you see a lot of people not make it after getting out of a cult?
Yes, there's an enormous amount of suicides, actually. Many of them by individuals who were born and raised in a cult. And my most recent book, which is called Escaping Utopia, is based on interviews I did with 65 people who were born and raised in a cult. And it was both men and women, and it covered 39 different cults. And when those people leave, and many of them left on their own without any help whatsoever, without their families, just on their own, like got the hell out of there. Many of them were adolescents when they left. And most of them were in highly restrictive groups. And when they get out into the world, so to speak, they don't know how to function. They don't know how to get a GED. Be able to go to college. They don't know how to write a college application. They don't know how to get a driver's license. They don't know where to go for help because there's an incredible lack of resources in our country. And this is really the biggest population now of people leaving cults are the second and third generation. Again, these people who did not decide to join, but who were either born in or brought in by their parents at a young age. And the trauma that they have experienced, which is then increased by the trauma of trying to survive outside in the world when, you know, they may not have any relatives out there. They just don't know where to go. They end up, a lot of them, in the streets. They end up doing drugs and getting into bad situations. It's an absolute tragedy, and it's really, in my opinion, one of the biggest public health issues in our country right now is trying to set up resources for these people. And it's part of the reason I wrote the book was to help educate helping professionals like therapists and social workers and first responders to be able to better understand the after effects of that kind of experience.
What was the name of that book again?
It's called Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out and Starting Over.
Okay, well, that sounds like the book we should be promoting in this episode.
Yes. And it's very, it's not academic. It was, I have a co-author who herself was born, raised in a cult. And so both of us are former members with, you know, personal experience and a good understanding. But it's not an academic book. It's really written for those survivors, and it's written for helping professionals. It's very down to earth. And hopefully we'll reach a wide audience.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And I love all the work that you're doing. I think it's so important. And, you know, props to you for using your, taking your lemons and making lemonade.
Thanks.
Well, we just covered so much ground there in such a short amount of time. Is there anything that you think we might have missed or anything that you didn't get to say that you wish you had?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people still think cults went away with the 60s and 70s, even though today there is a little more attention to it because of the Leah Remini series on Scientology that aired last year.
Yeah,
I think made people more aware. But people need to keep their eyes open and be on the alert, either for friends getting involved, for themselves getting involved. I mean, when we think of, you know, in California this year, we had that family who had kept their children prisoners. Well, that was what I call a family cult. And you know, that was right next door to a lot of people in a, you know, in a popular town. And so we need to keep our eyes open and watch out for our friends and neighbors and help them if we can, either help them avoid getting involved in that, or, you know, if it looks like trouble, call the authorities or do something.
A family cult. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of people in the comments throwing that word around really loosely. I'm in one of those. No. What's interesting about what you just said is that it expands the idea of cults beyond just religious or political, but also there's some families that just have an unhealthy amount of control and dominance, and I think that's pretty scary.
Right. And have some kind of belief system. Like in that case, that guy, you know, really was
making them believe he was some kind of god. And, you know, we also see what I call the one-on-one cults, where there are abusive relationships that are beyond sort of the, I don't want to call it ordinary, but beyond what we recognize as, say, domestic violence or an abusive relationship. But again, where there's a belief system involved. You know, there was a case recently of that was on NPR about a young boy who his parents hired a basketball coach, and the guy was, you know, filling this young boy's head with all kinds of ideas, starting when he was 6 years old, and he was with him for like 10 years. And so he was implanted with just crazy, nightmarish ideas about what was going to happen to him if he didn't follow this guy and do everything he said. So it comes in all shapes and sizes and forms.
Yeah, if it maybe a good indicator is if at the root of the system, all that exists is fear keeping you in there, maybe that should be a red flag.
Yes, yes.
Well, Yanya, it was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time. And I'm looking forward to getting this episode out and hearing people's thoughts on it. I think the work you're doing is so important, and it was awesome speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
I want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Are you in a cult? Could you be in a cult? I don't know. It's kind of a scary thing to ask. I'm 100% sure I'm not in a cult, and I'm squirming even asking that question. But, you know, I think this is an important conversation. I think a lot of people are probably going to get something out of this. And if you do, I want to hear your thoughts about that. Drop me a line in the comments. Let me know what you're thinking. And if you have something longer that you'd like to send, you can send it to hello@spellboundshow.com, and I will see it. Be sure to hit that subscribe button. That way you never miss an episode, and your phone will always stay up to date. Next week, we are talking to Peggy Orenstein, New York Times best-selling author of Don't Call Me Princess, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Waiting for Daisy, and a number of other great books. We were supposed to speak with her today, but instead we released this episode with Yanya because I just felt like, I don't know, I don't need a release, I don't need a reason, do I? But I'm very much looking forward to next week. I hope you all enjoyed this episode as much as I did. This has been Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith, and I will see you guys next Monday.